The Guardian.
Hello, and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Jemima Kish, standing in for Alex while she's globetrotting again. This week, we look at the news from the past 7 days, including Apple edging towards being the biggest company in the world, Ray Ozzie's departure from Microsoft, AOL sniffing around Yahoo, and discuss whether cyber warfare is to be the new era of global terrorism. We're also joined by games designer Kevin Slavin, founder of Area Code and now Starling.tv, who's fresh from speaking at Mint Digital's two-screen event, which was buzzing after his take on the future of TV. Welcome, Kevin. What are you up to in London this week?
Talking to everybody in London who makes television, which is a very talented group of people.
And a lot of people as well.
It turns out to be a lot of people.
Also joining me in the studio is Guardian's erstwhile technology editor, Charles Arthur. Charles, what technology have you been fiddling with this week?
That sounds so rude. I've been trying out a Nokia N8, actually two of them because I got one with updated firmware, and comparing it against an HTC HD7 running Windows Phone 7. I should have the reviews of both of those up imminently.
Fair enough. I have an interesting little something.
Jemima is now reaching into her bag.
Whoa.
This, gentlemen, is a paranormal activity sensor. I will just set it up on the desk. And we can see if anyone else will be joining us during the podcast. Here we go. Now, this is very high-level technology we're using here.
Did he get it cheap from the Scientologist? Does it run on a potato?
Yeah, it analyses your personality at the same time. Then let me see. Now, I think we're okay for the moment, but we'll have to keep listening just to make sure. So stay with us for the next half an hour as we get to the bottom of all this in Tech Weekly from The Guardian. We start with this week's news. First, Apple Incorporated. It used to be the Rebel Alliance, but now it's a Wookiee's hair's breadth from becoming the evil empire. By the end of the year, market watchers say, Apple's value will have overtaken Exxon to become the most valuable company in the world. Apple last night said it had sold another 4.1 million iPads, pushing its quarterly revenues to more than $20 billion and the company value up to $290 billion. Now, Charles, a $20 billion quarter seems very impressive, but what's the real significance of this?
Well, there's a lot of it. I mean, Microsoft has never done a $20 billion quarter. It reports its results next week, so it'll be interesting to see, that's next Wednesday, whether it can match Apple or exceed it. And there's all sorts of things you can pick out of it. iPods are declining. iPads, they didn't sell as many as they wanted to.
Because they thought they were going to sell 5 million
of those.
There
was an expectation sort of among analysts, and Apple said that it had 2.2 million, I think, in the channel, which it wanted to sell but couldn't, you know, for one reason or another, didn't get out there. I suspect that there's some people who have been holding off buying tablets because there's been so much noise about competitors like the Samsung Galaxy and all the others, and a lot of that needs to shake out at the beginning of next year when these start. Or even later this quarter when these things start appearing in the shops and people can compare them. The profits are big, the numbers are big. They sold 19.1 million iPhones, which is a big jump compared to last year. So the whole AntennaGate thing doesn't seem to have made any effect.
Now, Kevin, you're a bit sceptical about this whole company valuation business, aren't you?
I'm sceptical of using stock prices as an indication for success. I don't know if the paranormal activity monitor jumped at the words Apple or Exxon.
It was a slight flicker.
That can happen sometimes. The attention that's paid to valuation is often offset by the extreme paranormal activity of the American stock market and is often best taken with more than a grain of salt.
But then the question is, how do you value a company? You know, if you had a company and you're running a company and someone wants to buy your company, how do you value it? You know, the capitalization, which is the stock price times the number of shares, is a pretty straightforward way of doing it. And, you know, the rationale is, and I explained this a few weeks back when Apple overtook Microsoft, is that the market says, okay, well, this is the net present value of all the profits that this company is going to make in its lifetime. And it sort of, you know, sometimes it goes up, sometimes it goes down, because it says, oh, BP, you've had a big oil spill, you know, it's going to cost you, that comes out of your profits, therefore your stock goes down. Well, how else are you going to do it?
It's an excellent question. I'm not in the company acquisition business, so it's all
about
a bit
being acquired.
it's a bit vague for me, but I think that the important numbers are the numbers that you pointed out, which is incredibly strong sales that continue to climb, and that the idea that you can do a slow iteration on a product like the iPhone and continue to sell more and more of them is pretty remarkable.
And how much of, it's an interesting point though, how much of Apple's value does come down to its perception of value, and how much comes down to genuinely useful market-defining products?
That's really hard to say. I mean, I think that if you were to do... I mean, it's got $50 billion sitting in a bank somewhere, so there must be some very happy bankers
That's
somewhere.
A bit more than me.
Yeah, it's possibly they could share it out. Actually, Steve Jobs was asked, what about this $50 billion? It's sitting around, hardly earning you any money. And he sort of hinted at acquisition, a strategic acquisition. I mean, I was trying what things are there? What is a really big, career-defining acquisition that Apple could make? And I don't actually know. I can't think of it, because it wouldn't be a Facebook. It wouldn't be a Twitter, because he was saying that, you know, what Apple has, it's a systems integrator. You know, it puts hardware together, it puts software together. And the interesting question is, what sort of companies are there out there that he will want to be his legacy? Because I think that he's possibly getting to the age now and the sort of the, you know, his health possibly to the point where he wants to leave a real legacy. But the danger, of course, is that you do a big acquisition.
Well,
big
it's unlikely to be social networking, and actually shouldn't be social networking, I'd argue. Do you think, my last point, do you think that the flaw in iPhone 4 shows that Apple does have some vulnerabilities and that it could well lose its way in the future?
Every company has vulnerabilities, and yes, it could lose its way. But I think that the whole iPad thing is only just starting. This morning on the train, I was sitting opposite a guy who was using an iPad, and he had a BlackBerry. And I said, excuse me, the BlackBerry's from your company and the iPad is yours. And he said, that's right. And I said, why do you have the iPad? And he said, well, they're restaurateurs. And he finds it's much easier to use the iPad. And I suspect that that's going to be a sort of paradigm of how it is. He says, you know, if I want to show a chef a recipe, I can just bring the picture up, I can hand it around to them, they can look at it, they can expand it, it's more interactive. And there's something coming there. Jobs hinted at it. He said, you know, we think we've got a tiger by the tail in this. They're selling more iPads than they are Macintosh computers, and they sold more Macintosh computers this quarter than they ever have. So, you know, something is going on.
Someone went to a startup networking event recently where they were using iPads as trays for the drinks. Anyway, moving on to the other evil empire, Microsoft's chief software architect, Ray Ozzie, who took over from Bill Gates in 2006, is the latest high-level executive to leave the company. Charles, what's the backstory here? Is there trouble at the top?
Well, there's politics at the top. I mean, Microsoft is an intensely political company. And may I just say how fantastically lucky we are as a planet to have two evil empires on it, not just one Microsoft, but
two Death Stars.
That's right. And hey, come on, Mr. Vader, we'll take you on.
Yes.
Ray Ozzie came from Groove Networks, which Microsoft bought in 2005. Ray Ozzie, you may be more familiar with as the man who invented Lotus Notes.
I didn't know
which
that.
Which we adore and love, and we're so sad that we don't use it from day to day. And he was brought on because Bill Gates thinks he's absolutely fantastic. And Bill Gates had preceded him as chief software architect. No one knew what the hell that was. But basically, with Bill Gates, it meant he tried out all the products Microsoft did before they got out the door, at least once while he was doing that job. He would try it out, and he would write whiny emails if they didn't work, which makes sense to me, actually. You're the guy who co-founded the company. You're the guy in charge. You should be able to say if the product sucks. Ray Ozzie came in from outside 2006 as Bill Gates faded out of the company. He becomes chief software architect. So he's working alongside sort of Steve Ballmer. And what Ray Ozzie and Bill Gates had both pushed was the idea that it was all moving to cloud computing, you know, that Microsoft was going to have to get with the game here, that it's all shifting to online. It's in the cloud. You're not going to have quite the same revenues perhaps as you did from desktops, but, you know, this is how things are. It's all changing. And he pushed and Microsoft has developed some cloud services, though you wouldn't say that they're doing it with any great enthusiasm. And now he seems to have just been edged out, you know, just pushed into irrelevance. And Steve Ballmer sent around something saying, I'm sure we're going to thank Ray for his time here, and bye!
Kevin?
And do we get a new chief software architect?
Or we don't. He is the last of the line. There is no more. So
there is no more software to be architected.
Huh. Mm. Or
at least cheaply.
Yeah. Maybe it's just something you put up on Craigslist see who applies.
Have a look. Yeah. I wonder what he's done to his LinkedIn profile. It's always a good way to check where people are planning to go next. But any ideas, Charles, where he might pop up again?
Well, I think he's probably got enough money from selling Groove Networks to Microsoft that he doesn't need to worry about it. But,
Bahamas, then.
He could, well, yes, he could, though he could sort of go to IBM, work on Lotus Notes, give it an interface that at least works for the 20th century, and then see if they can update it to the 21st. That would be a sort of way to round off your career.
Or he could not.
Possibly. That would imply Notes has reached its absolute apex, which I think can't be quite true.
Oh, let's just not go down.
But I think for Microsoft, it's interesting because it does indicate that the whole political thing of we've got to stick with Windows, we've got to stick with Office, they've got to be on the desktop, that's where the money is, we don't go out of this comfort zone. I think that this indicates that view has prevailed, and I think that the way that affects how Microsoft moves in the future is going to be very interesting. So I think that it'll be very interesting to study
what
happens.
So no cloud?
Well, some cloud. A bit of cloud.
A little bit of
cloud. But not so much that it obscures the view of the Windows.
Oh. With the Microsoft new App Store.
Well, I've been playing with that a bit on Windows Phone 7, and I think I'm having phone troubles there. It's pretty empty so far.
Now, moving on, cyber warfare is a growing threat to UK security, the UK's Home Secretary has warned. The government has prioritised resources to the tune of £500 million to counter the threat from terrorist cyber attacks. The government has not said whether it would develop US-style defensive cyber warfare weaponry, however. Here's Home Office Security Minister Lady Neville Jones warning of an increased threat of cyber warfare.
The government has to defend the nation against espionage through cyber, against crime through cyber, and also the sinews of our society, the things like our water grids and our power, which are all controlled by computer these days. That we have to do with the private sector, because they're very often the owners and the operators. Mostly they are. So this is going to be an all-nation approach. That's to say it's going to be government, private companies, private sector, and thirdly also the general public, you and me, making sure actually that we use our computers sensibly, that we actually do our patches, we take our own personal security seriously. We aren't silly about the information we put about ourselves out onto the internet, that we actually damage our own personal security. All of those things. And we'll be saying all of that, as you will see, in the strategy as it comes out.
The cyber. Very interesting. That was Lady Neville Jones. Charles, what's the background here and how much of a threat is there really to the UK's security?
Well, the background is that the government did a big look at where the future threats come from, and they reckoned that physical terrorism was very much the one that would be the real risk. But the second one on the list was cyber warfare, which they think is an increasingly real threat. And you can actually, you know, we discussed Stuxnet a couple of weeks ago. That's a very real piece of engineering, which is government level in the quality of the work that's been done, and also is attacking a cyber target. And there have been examples in the past. There's been Titan Rain, which the US described as a lot of attacks apparently come from China, which were targeting people in the Pentagon. And there was a similar attack on MPs in the UK. And there have also been attacks, basically to extract information by Chinese hackers, it appears, on lots of automotive and aerospace companies.
Yeah. Kevin, how do you think the government can ever keep up with extremely advanced hackers on either side, I suppose, hackers for good or for bad?
Well, I guess Ray Ozzie's looking for a job, right? So that yeah, maybe that could help.
Get the other side to hire him. I know, we'll use Notes, that'll do it.
God.
It's a difficult question because on the one hand, you're better off with a heterogeneous ecosystem, which means that you're less likely to be affected by a single unified attack. But on the other hand, you, of course, have no control in an ecosystem like that. So I'm not an expert, and there's a reason for that.
That's what you would say.
That is what I'd say. What I would say, though, is that I guess it was about a year ago that UBS was fined considerably by the SEC for an algorithm that went bad in the U.S. stock market, and that the real cyber warfare of the future looks more like something financial than infrastructural.
Flash crash and stuff like that.
Hacking, yeah. Messing up the stock markets.
Indeed. I mean, not want to give anybody ideas. I'm just, you know,
just throwing that one out.
Yeah, just put that out there.
Yeah, take that and run. Yeah. Okay, as ever, there's more on all these. Oh, hang on. I think we're just witnessing some paranormal activity. Is there someone called Mary?
Alex?
Alex? Is there anyone called...
Is she with us in spirit?
Oh, no, it's gone now. So there's more on all these stories on guardian.co.uk/tech. Before we move on, a heads up that we'll be heading to Bradford on the 9th of November, taking the programme to the Animation Festival at the National Media Museum. Keith Stewart will be there talking to the acclaimed director Charles Cecil of Revolution Software, who's been involved in hits like Ship of Doom, Broken Sword, and more recently, Doctor Who The Adventure Games. Comic book author and journalist Kieran Gillen, who's written for loads of games magazines and is now working with Marvel Comics. And games artist Dan Pinchbeck, also a lecturer in games at Portsmouth University. What's on the syllabus there, I wonder? We'll go along and ask him. If you want to go, tickets are free. Find out how on this week's programme page at guardian.co.uk/techweekly, or click the link that's on your iPod screen now. And as further proof of de-Londonising Guardian Tech, we'll also be taking Tech Weekly to Dublin in November to meet some of Ireland's finest startup talent and tech brains. But more on that next week. Now, what's the future of television? It seems increasingly likely that the answer to that question lies outside the traditional TV industry. Kevin Slavin, founder of New York-based games company Area Code, has his own vision of that future, and he's creating it at starling.tv. So, Kevin, give us the top line. What is Starling TV and how does it work?
Starling is a platform that's responding to an existing behavior, and that behavior is often referred to as co-viewing. And co-viewing is what people are doing while they are also watching TV. In the UK, as in the US, somewhere around between 60 and 70% of people who are watching TV are doing something else at the same time, usually something that involves a screen. If you look at Twitter, I guess 2 Mondays ago, when Glee was broadcast, it took 4 of the top 10 trends on Twitter were about Glee. It's not that there was nothing else going on, but what you see is that there's a real desire for people who are watching the same thing at the same time to actually somehow reestablish an audience. And that's something that television, I think, really took for granted for somewhere around 50 years or so.
So how do you do that then on Starling?
A big broadcast in the States, you could get around 4,000 tweets in a minute just around something, which unless you're a robot is very difficult to read and process. So with Starling, basically what we do is we bring it down to a threshold and say it's X number of messages in a minute. And then we filter those out by the messages that are going to be most relevant to you. The ones that are from your friends, the ones that are from friends of friends, the ones that are from people who consistently say interesting things, etc. And so really it's saying there is a thriving and sort of vibrant fan activity around a show, and we're going to allow this much of it through the door so that you have really the sense of the audience around you.
So how do you do that? What does Starling actually look like, and do you get people to engage with it?
It looks like a sort of strange hybrid between something that has the sort of speed and velocity of something like Twitter with the sort of production quality and sensibilities of television. What we have in Starling are cards, basically. The cards have images on them that are sort of broken off from the show. So if it's Glee, it might have images of the cast, it might have scenes from the show, etc. And the messages that you're putting out into the stream are actually sort of juxtaposed against those cards that you're playing.
So it might be like a Mercedes card, for example.
Well, there could be a Mercedes card. Mm. I think overall, I can't say that we ever anticipated looking to this for inspiration, but we ended up looking at things like MySpace and realizing that one of the things that was actually really beautiful about MySpace that got lost in the shift to Facebook and Twitter that most people engaged in is that MySpace was super visual. It was all about the kind of bling. And if you actually look at what people were putting up there, it wasn't images of themselves or their friends or whatever. It was images of things that they liked, of movies that they liked or things that they wanted, et cetera. And we basically want to bring that back and bring back that sensibility that we communicate not just with 140 characters at a time, but through imagery and in particular around media. So when we're watching Glee, we're sort of breaking off little visual pieces of it and exchanging those with each other.
Why does it need to be visual? Because, I mean, for example, over here in the UK, X Factor is a big show on Saturdays. You know, a lot of people quite enjoy watching X Factor. They'll have a laptop as well, mm-hmm. or whatever, and they'll be, you know, on Twitter. How is what you're proposing or, you know, what you're offering, how is it better than that? Because I don't quite get why one needs to move to a totally different place and mm-hmm. say, okay, now come over to this place mm-hmm. and interact in a different way.
This thing that we're used to is, you know, we haven't been doing it very long either, no, sure. And that these types of things move very quickly. But I think that also when we're looking for specific types of behavior, specific types of declaration or expression, for example, around location-based services, those are things that the Twitters and the Facebooks were not exceptionally good at precisely because they were designed to accommodate any kind of message. So that's why things like Foursquare, Gowalla, et cetera, emerge, is that they focus the conversation around a specific use, in that case, where I am.
Is this something that's designed for, I don't know, Google TV or a place where it will sit more neatly alongside a video screen that's mm-hmm. on the same screen as the TV?
The premise of television was always that it commands all of your attention and that you won't be doing anything else at the same time. And of course, one way or the other, we know that there is a divided attention. When we're designing Starling and when we're rolling it out, we're designing for that sort of secondary attention. It's exactly the point that we're not trying to pull you away from the TV, from the primary signal. So it has to work at a glance. It has to work in sort of the smallest possible ways. The idea is not to demand attention from people, but actually to kind of reward what little bits of it kind of break off when you're not totally focused.
Kevin, you have a background in the games industry. Is it an indictment of the TV industry that these ideas and this talent isn't coming from within, or do they just get on board when they think there's an advertising or marketing potential there?
Well, I mean, TV's a big industry, and big industries tend to carry on for as long as they can until something forces change. I think that the ways that the TV industry has evolved have been around understanding themselves to be competing with each other, that every network is competing against another network. And that's just not really how the internet works. That's not really how games work. The main difference between TV and games is really that at the middle of the game is you. That's what games mean. Games are about your participation in it. And TV has always been about something that you consume. It's something that you use up and then it's done. The thing that games do so effectively, that's sort of in a way the opposite of linear media, is that they increase in value over time. The 10th time you watch that same episode of Battlestar Galactica is probably less interesting than the first time, but the 10th time you play chess is much better than the first time, and the 100th time you play chess is way better than the 10th time. And so if we can start to bring those kinds of dynamics to linear media so that they can increase in value over time, so that we can actually start to get that type of participation to build up value over time, that's something that is definitely in TV's interest.
You heard it here first. Kevin, what stage is Starling.tv in at the moment? You're still in beta tests. Where can people get a taste of this?
It's in beta starting in about 2 weeks, and we'll be running through that for about 2 months. And January is where it rolls out with some big properties in the US and perhaps here in the UK as well.
You can find out more at Starling.tv. I was about to say that's all for Tech Weekly this week, but it looks like we might have that other guest arriving. Any indication? Is anyone getting any sensations about who it might be?
Shall I put the magnet down now?
Oh, okay, I have to fess up. This is a Paranormal Activity monitor that I was sent to promote the film Paranormal Activity. I'm sure plenty of you guessed that, so 10 house points to you. That really is all for Tech Weekly this week. Join us when Alex returns next week. She'll just have stepped off a flight from Taiwan, so we'll be feeling fresh as a daisy when she comes into the studio next Tuesday. Thanks very much to Charles Arthur and for Kevin Slavin for coming in this week. All the links to anything we've mentioned are at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. The programme was produced by Scott Corley, and I'm Jemima Kish. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.